So since I'm the first one to talk about quantum metrology in theoretical terms here in this meeting, I thought I'd give like a three-slide top executive summary of what this whole thing is about. So forget about quantum mechanics for one slide and just think about classical parameter estimation, because that's what we'll be actually doing in quantum metrology. So here we have the problem that we are given some distribution P of A that depends on some parameter X. And we are allowed to sample that distribution m times. So we get random results, AI, and the task is to estimate as best as possible from the knowledge of our distribution and these measurement results, what would be the parameter x. To do so, we create some estimator function, so that takes as input all these measurement results and puts out the estimate of the parameter. And what we want, of course, is that on the average, the estimator should give back the correct value of x. This is called an unbiased estimator. And of course, this estimator is fluctuating. If you draw random results, then also this function is fluctuating. And so we can talk about the uncertainty of the estimate. It's just a standard deviation of this estimator. And the task is to find the best possible estimator. So this is an optimization problem. That was solved by Kramer and Rao and gives rise to the so-called quantum, the classical Kramer-Rao bound for the moment. So this is the bound, so delta x, the uncertainty is larger or equal than this 1 over square root of m times the Fisher information. And here is the Fisher information, it's a functional of this distribution. It only depends on the distribution, how the distribution depends on the parameter x. And you see, you can think of it as the expectation value of this logarithmic derivative squared of the distribution with respect to x. These two people actually worked on this independently. Here is a, I think, very rare picture of seeing them together. Rao did this as his PhD work with Fisher. And actually, you should look him up because he's a very inspirational person. He will be 100 years old next year, still alive, and just authored another book, I think, last year or 2 years ago. He has like 46 honorary PhD degrees. He's like top 10 scientists of any of all times. Amazing guy. Kramer was already in his 50s and got into the probability theory. I mean, it was really not very well developed in the 40s when this came up through number theory. And the important thing about this estimator and the Kramer-Rao bound is that you can actually saturate it with a particular estimator function, which is called the maximum likelihood estimator. It makes an important lower bound because it can be saturated. Now, in quantum mechanics, the situation is a bit different. We don't start off with some probability distribution. We have to create, actually, probability distributions. All what we have is a state, rho x, that depends on the parameter x, and then we can decide whatever we want to measure. So we are free to measure, and we can optimize then once more over all measurements, here all POVM measurements. And if you do so, then you get another bound, which is the so-called quantum Kramer-Rao bound. So it's a very similar structure. So the smallest uncertainty of your estimator is given by this bound here, 1 over square root of m once more, and then 1 over square root of the quantum Fisher information, where again the quantum Fisher information can be seen of as the expectation value of a logarithmic derivative. So since rho x is an operator and it doesn't necessarily commute with its own derivative, one constructs it in this symmetrized way. But you see, if you could divide just by rho x, you would see the logarithmic derivative here, and this is what defines this. All rho x is another operator that gives the logarithmic derivative, the symmetric logarithmic derivative. So all of this was invented in 1960s by Hillström, was a radar engineer, and then picked up by the mathematicians a bit later, Holevo in particular. And so also the nice thing about this bound is that it can be saturated. So there exists a certain measurement, the POVM measurement, and this data analysis possible. Best possible estimator that allows one to saturate the bound. And so it is an ultimate bound that you can reach once you solve all your technical problems, technical noise problems. It's really just a property of the state itself. It gives you quantum information, theoretical interpretation of the best possible measurement that you can do, and the uncertainty of your parameter estimation that you will get out of it. There's a nice physical interpretation of it. In fact, the Fisher information that shows up in this bound here can be seen as related to the burst distance between two states, rho x and rho fx plus dx. If you don't know about burst distance, never mind, but it really tells you I mean, it's really a measure of a distance. And so the larger the difference between these two states, the more they are far away from each other. If you just change x slightly, tells you how well you can measure the state, actually the parameter, estimate the parameter. Clearly, if this was the same state, it didn't depend at all on x, there's no way to estimate x. Okay, so this is the basic tool in the field. One has to calculate the quantum Fisher information, and this will tell you what is the best possible measurement you can achieve. And now with this preliminaries, we can get to the real topic of the talk, which are quantum chaotic sensors. And the general motivation, actually there will be two steps of motivation, I would say, to look at this is that so far as I am aware of, sensors are normally really integrable systems. They might be harmonic oscillators, like just a needle is essentially a harmonic oscillator. Could also be a light mode is also an oscillator, harmonic oscillator. Could be a processing spin in magnetic field. So all of these are integrable motions. And just from the curiosity, you might ask, okay, what happens if you go away from this kind of dynamics, if you go to chaotic dynamics? And one important aspect here is that you can actually render some systems chaotic by kicking them, by driving in the correct way, putting in some nonlinear time-dependent parts. You can drive some systems into a chaotic regime, and we're coming back to this in a second. So if you talk about quantum chaos, we always have to make a point that quantum chaos is not the same thing as classical chaos. Certainly everybody has some notion about classical chaos, and one important aspect of classical chaos is that you have this exponential sensitivity to initial conditions. People call this the butterfly effect, but what it really is you have locally in phase space, let's say, you have some instability. So if you have a slight change in your initial conditions, the trajectories diverge away from them from each other exponentially. This can be captured with this Lyapunov exponent. So it's really like you change slightly the initial position by some distance d0 between them, and then this distance will grow exponentially as a function of time. And you look at this in the limit of d0 going to 0 and infinite time limit. So this Lyapunov exponent really picks up the exponent of the exponential growth of this distance between the two trajectories. Now, as I said, it's a local property. You go to some different place in phase space, and then you will typically get a different Lyapunov exponent. It can also be 0, which meaning there is no instability. And this is really a typical situation. You have a mixed phase space, so some regions are stable, some others are unstable. It's very hard to get complete full chaos everywhere in your phase space. So, for example, here the Hanon attractor, a very famous example. You are essentially stable. You oscillate here, and then, or the other way around, like this way. But once you get to this point here, there's something like a separatrix. So if it's slightly on one side or the other, it makes a completely different long-term behavior. And this is one of these aspects of chaos. Now, quantum mechanically, this is impossible. We know, at least for unitary time evolution, that the scalar product between two states, psi 1 and psi 2, as function of time, will be constant. So there's no exponential separation between the two states in your Hilbert space. It's really the scalar product is constant. So this type of sensitivity does just not exist in the quantum world when we talk about states in Hilbert space. But what has been known for a long time is there is a certain sensitivity to parameters of the system. This was found probably for the first time by Peres in 1995. And in fact, he looked at this kind of fidelity, which is also called the Luschmidt echo. So you propagate a state with a unitary that depends on some parameter alpha here for a certain time, and then you propagate it back with a slightly changed parameter of a unitary. Then you look at the overlap, and this overlap will, if you have a chaotic system, classically chaotic, so here's a quantum chaotic system, will decay very, very rapidly. In fact, as function of time, after a short initial time, will decay exponentially. Whereas in the regular regime, it goes down very slowly. So this has been known for a long time, and so this motivated us to think about, can this not be used for metrology? Because obviously, if you have this sensitivity to parameters of the system, this is exactly what we want for a good measurement instrument. Now, interestingly, it turns out that this Luschmidt echo here is very much related, in fact, to the Fisher information, the quantum Fisher information. If you take the limit of this quantity here, actually 1 minus this fidelity, divided by delta alpha square and then up to a factor of 4 in the limit of delta alpha to 0. This turns out to be exactly the quantum Fisher information. So the same type of sensitivity that people have been looking at for a long time in quantum chaos actually shows up naturally in the study of quantum metrology. So this means that we can learn a lot about the viability of quantum chaotic sensors just by looking at the literature on quantum chaotic systems, particular literature on Loschmidt echo. And there's a lot of it. There's, for example, this review article that I can recommend everybody by Marco Cnidaric and colleagues from, when was it, 2006. And so we can really get inspired and extract information and make predictions about the sensitivity of our quantum chaotic sensors. Now, here's the first model system that we will look at. It's the so-called kicked top. This was invented by my former boss, Fritz Hake, Marek Kusch, and Rainer Scharf in the 1980s. And it's a very well studied, simple quantum chaotic system, so you can go all the way from integrable to chaotic. First of all, it has this part here, so it's a big spin. J is the size of the spin, and so the Hamiltonian alpha JZ would tell you it's just a precession about the z-axis. Alpha might be a magnetic field in that direction. But then you add this time-dependent part here. So periodically, you kick the system with a nonlinearity. So this JY square makes for a nonlinear rotation about the y-axis. So you can think of it as rotating about the y-axis, but with an angle that is itself proportional to JY, right? So that's the nonlinearity, and you rescale it so that the two terms in the limit of J to infinity are still comparable, and K is then the kicking strength. So these are the two parameters, rotation angle alpha and kicking strength K, that we keep track of, and period we set equal to 1, and also H bar equal to 1. Then we can describe the system with this stroboscopic description, the Floquet operator. It just integrate the time evolution operator from some time t to some time t plus the period. And this decomposes into just the rotation, which is on all the time. And then at some points when we kick the thing, you get this nonlinear unitary evolution. And the two can just be multiplied. And this gives the whole propagation from one time step to the next one. So it's very simple. And so if you think of it in terms of metrology, what we're doing here is then, well, normally you prepare some state and then let the system evolve with, let's say, some rotation here about the z-axis by an angle alpha. And in the end, you measure something. And what we're doing now is that we disrupt this evolution. Give periodic kicks that really disrupt the encoding of the parameter. And you might think, is this useful or not? And I'll try to convince you that, yes, this is actually very useful. We have to think about two timescales here. They're very typical of quantum chaotic systems. The first one is the so-called Ehrenfest time. That's the time that a small uncertainty on the scale of the Planck scale needs to spread over the whole Hilbert space. So it goes logarithmically with the volume of your phase space. And I should also have said the size of Hilbert space is proportional to J here. And so this will be logarithmic in J in the end. Then there's the Heisenberg time, which is a much longer time. It's given by the inverse level spacing of the system. So this scales like 1 over J. Here are two typical phase space portraits that are actually from an experimental paper that realized this kick top, Chaudhuri et al. In 2009. And so you see essentially the Bloch sphere from behind and from front of it. This is JZ, this is JX, rescaled. And so this was for K, well, it's 2.0 here. So in that region, you get a mixed phase space. If K was equal to 0, you would just see the rotation, it would just be circles. And you see still the remnants of this rotation about the axis they used here. I guess it's the JY axis indeed, instead of JZ. So you see the remnants of it, but it breaks up due to this chaotic term. And if you go to larger values of K, you would just see completely structureless phase space, essentially. The spin will jump all over the place classically. Now, the interesting thing about this is that we want to get away from preparing highly entangled states. So in all what I'm showing you, we always prepare initial SU2 coherent states. So these are the most classical states you can think of. It's really like the end momentum is concentrated in one direction as much as possible quantum mechanically minimal uncertainty. No fancy superpositions. We really want to have a very simple initial state. Then there are two benchmarks that we should compare ourselves to. In fact, in this field, everybody tries to arrive at the so-called Heisenberg scaling, which is a scaling as here it would be J squared, but J is really the number of spins, 1/2 involved in this big spin J you're looking at. So scaling proportion to N squared is called the Heisenberg limit, and is really the ultimate goal in the field. And the other thing is the so-called standard quantum limit that scales only proportional to N, meaning proportional to J here. And so that's what you get for free, so to say, if you start with an initial as your two current state, and you just let it rotate without any kicking, this is the quantum official information that you will end up with. So these are the two benchmarks, and here are the first numerical results. So it's the quantum official information as function of time, and here as function of the spin size for different values of J here and for different values of T. Now I said we can essentially predict what happens from known results of the Loschmidt echo, and it was known that for times comparable to this Ehrenfest time, the Loschmidt echo indicates that the Fisher information should scale like TJ square. So for sufficiently small times, and I put the Ehrenfest time in here, it's about here, just a few kicks, just a few evolutions. We are at the Ehrenfest time, and then we get the scaling proportion of J square. We actually also see it here as function of J. It numerically also goes essentially up as J square for small times. Then if increase time, then the scaling with J reduces, and also this is expected from the Loschmidt echo results. So it becomes proportional only to J for much larger times. If you go beyond the Heisenberg time, it scales down only, I mean, it goes like J. And on the other hand, the scaling with time is also interesting. If you're close to the Ehrenfest time, it only goes up linearly with time, which is kind of unusual in quantum metrology. Just from coherence itself, you would normally expect it goes like time square, and this is what actually happens for sufficiently large times here. And we also see this happening here. You go from linear with T to quadratic with T. All right, now we can really compare the two things, like quantum official information with kicking and without kicking. And this is what I call I-top, just a regular top without any kicking. This is KT means kick top, and starting with this coherent state in the equatorial plane to get maximum sensitivity for just a regular rotation. And then just take the ratio between the two of them, and as function of time, we see that, well, if you have sufficiently large spin, we can get a huge enhancement in the Fisher information. If you go to longer times, it actually becomes essentially independent of J, and kicking becomes disadvantages. And disadvantage, I mean, you reduce the Fisher information effect. So the advantage is mostly in short times, and for metrology, this is interesting. You want to measure as quickly as possible, and we'll come back to this point actually in a second. But before this, I want to show you it's really related to the chaos. So what we can do, we can look at the classical phase space pot trace. So here we plotted the Lyapunov exponent as function of position in phase space. This phase space is just the azimuthal angle and the z component of the spin. And you see it maps perfectly the gain in the quantum Fisher information. So here in the chaotic C, we get a much larger Fisher information, increased by a factor, I mean, a few orders of 10, a few factors of 10. And inside this stability islands, you actually reduce the Fisher information. The most interesting states are those right on the border. We call those the edge states. You see, this is the largest gain in Fisher information you can get right on these edge states here of these two stability islands. And I think the physical intuition behind is that these states have a finite size, right? So one part will be stuck in this stability island, the other is torn apart and goes out into phase space. So this makes a very high sensitivity. Okay, so this is a workshop about open quantum systems, and so far I haven't said any word about open quantum systems at all. But obviously any quantum technology has to make a statement how well it behaves under anticoherence and dissipation. So we added a damping mechanism, and to start with just this simple superradiant damping that probably most of you know. So it's a collective emission process that we know from quantum optics, but you can write this down for a spin, a simple Markovian decoherence, where gamma would measure the strength of the dissipation. In fact, we use this dimensionless parameter here, 2j gamma tau is a good measure of the decoherence in the dissipation in the problem. And so this super radiant damping commutes with the precession about the z-axis, so we can leave it on all the time. And during the kick, it can be neglected. And so you get this mapping now of the density matrix from one time step to the next one. So you have this dissipative evolution with the super radiant damping and then your unitary transformations. Now, also this has a classical limit, and I mean, I wrote on quantum chaos many, many years ago, and in fact, I didn't think I would come back to it 20 years later, but it turns out this system has a very interesting classical phase-space structure. It leads to a strange attractor in phase space that is multifractal, and you see it's a very filigrane structure, and if you look at the quantum mechanical pendant of it, then you see essentially you get a smeared-out strange attractor, smeared out on a scale of 1 over j, which is each bar in the problem. So it's somehow intuitively clear that this kind of structure can still have a lot of information about the parameter in the problem. And so this is what we see. So now this is the dissipative kick top, a relatively small dimensionless dissipation here, 10 to the minus 3 or 10 to the minus 4, also 10 to the minus 3 up to 10 to the minus 2. And we compare again the no kick, k equals 0, with k equals 30, a very strong chaotic parameter regime. So we see as function of time the quantum Fischer information without kicking, well, it will go up and then reach some maximum, and then it will decay to 0. It just goes down on this log scale to minus infinity, which is clear because the whole system just relaxes to the ground state. So there's no sensitivity to any rotation about the z-axis left, of course. On the other hand, for the kicked dissipative top here, well, we go also up, in this case, not as much as for no kicking, but the maximum is reached earlier. And then at long times, you also have this advantage that you reach this steady state that I just mentioned that corresponds to this non-equilibrium situation where you balance the energy loss with the energy being put back into the system by kicking. And so still here you have, for long times, you have this finite quantum Fischer information. And it really depends on the parameters, how things behave. So I said here the maximum is lower than this one here, but there's also the other way around. Like in these curves here, the maximum for the kick case is higher than the ones without the kick. So all these dashed lines is without kick. Here the corresponding color one goes down like this. And so it's really a question of parameter regime, which often you don't have much choice. I mean, dissipation might be there. You can fight as much as you want, but then there's some left. And then you can choose your kicking in order possibly to find possible enhancement. And so I guess I have to speed up in 5 minutes. 3 minutes, okay. So just to show this, I mean, there's a parameter regime where it really helps, and we can analyze this in more detail, but I guess I skip this. We can talk about it because I want to show you it actually works in real life, and this might connect to some experiments that somebody may want to do. We can really improve a self-magnetometer, which is state-of-the-art magnetometer that is based on spin precession. And so I guess I have to skip the details, but it's really what we're doing here. So the spin precesses, but we really made a very detailed atomic physics model. Actually, we didn't make it, but we used it from the literature, of course. So we have a model that really includes all the decoherence mechanisms, including decoherence that comes in from kicking. So the kicking is done here by some AC nonlinear Stark shift, and it induces additional decoherence. We take all of this into account. And so here the spin is very small, it's just f equals 3, but still we get actually quite a nice improvement. So this is again based on Fischer information, so it's essentially ideal measurement. You get about a factor 1.5 reduction of uncertainty. If you use the usual readout of the system, which is by Faraday effect, then you get actually a factor 3 improvement in the sensitivity. Maybe three last slides, also going into the discussion and making a connection to the next talk. I think one interesting thing is that we have now a huge degree of freedom, or actually many degrees of freedom that were not there before. We have all these kicks, so we can think about, can we vary the kicking times, kicking strength, and so on. We don't have to do this very periodically. And so it becomes a very high-dimensional optimization problem, calls for machine learning. In fact, reinforcement learning is here the optimal way to do it. I guess I don't have the time to explain what it is, but it's really a paradigm in machine learning. And so here comes in the work of Jonas in his bachelor thesis. And in fact, I'm surprised how well it works. It's actually almost shocking. I mean, we thought we were like kind of smart looking at this, looking at these chaotic systems and getting all the information and what has been collected in quantum chaos about Loschmidt echoes and so on, but the machine does much better. So here are two curves. I mean, these are preliminary results. It's not published yet, but so once more Fisher information is in blue here, if you don't do any kicking at all, we'll just relax to the ground state. This is what we got with our periodic kicks, quantum chaotic system, and this is what the machine learned how to do. So this blue crosses correspond to quantum Fisher information that were learned by the machine after many iterations of just trying out and then getting the best ones and so on. And you see that's really like almost the order of magnitude increase beyond what we could do by just thinking. And then here the connection to Antonella's talk, she does actually something quite similar as far as I understand. She has a way of fighting decoherence here in entanglement breaking channels. And he does something similar in the sense that she intercepts this propagation with unitaries. So I don't want to spoil her talk, but I think there's this common connection that we do something in between. We have unitaries that we intercept in a time evolution that this is dissipative. And so here are some questions that we might then discuss in the breakout session. All right, so here are the conclusions. I think we are really at the start of exploring this additional degree of freedom, which is really dynamics in sensing. We started doing so by looking at quantum chaotic systems versus integrable systems, but it's even much more general. We can really think of this kicking and unitaries that are intercepting the general time evolution that codes the parameter as a new degree of freedom or many degrees of freedom and try to optimize this. And this is very flexible. It can adapt to different decoherence mechanisms. And we show that we can get a large gain in sensitivity even for the simple kick top, but also it works in real life for the soft magnetometer and actually filed even a patent application for it. And we are just at the beginning of understanding that indeed it can be pushed even much further and the machine can learn how to do that. Thank you very much.
So thank you very much for this talk. We have time for questions.
Hi, very nice talk. So I have two related questions. So the first one is, in these large spin cases, what is the readout protocol that you would need? Because the quantum Fisher information, you need to optimize over the readout. And the second one related to that is, a lot of magnetometers work with small spin, but with many of them. And that in principle could be mapped to a larger spin system, but typically then your readout is only global, so then are these types of, so the dynamics could still be chaotic, but the readout to probe that and extract that information might be difficult.
Yeah.
So I was wondering if you had
okay, so readout, typically it's done with the Faraday effect, so it's a rotation of polarization depending on your state, and so this is what we compare to here, right? I mean, this is the, indeed, JZ measure means it's by Faraday effect. So that's the standard thing to do, and it's not an optimal measurement, it's clear, but it's the one which is easy. And if you use this one, we get this even larger improvement, what you could expect from Fisher information. The second thing is very interesting about the size of the spin. Indeed, I said here, we have only F equals 3, but we have very many atoms. So if you have a precession, in fact, for the precession, the spin is very large. It's just the sum of the spins. But if you want to have a term JY square, which JY is the total spin, then you get all these interaction terms in between, right? Like sigma y or j, little jy, I times jyj and so on, some more ij. And this needs interaction between the spins. So this is where we really connect to squeezing physics, spin squeezing physics. They also need these interactions. It's very similar Hamiltonians indeed. And so if you have actually an interaction between your atoms, you can make the jy square with a much, much larger j. And then indeed, this is where we expect much larger gains of Fisher information of sensitivity. But this is harder to do. I mean, we need interactions and then you have to control these and so on.
Me next, yeah. So I have two questions. So the first is, you were telling us about that with the kicks, the increase in the quantum Fisher information.
Yes.
But the usual property people look at is the n scaling So yes, regarding the Heisenberg limit, did you show that, or did you check it at the beginning here?
So the n scaling is the j scaling here, right? J is n over 2.
All right.
And it's the number of spin 1/2. And so you see that's the scaling like j and this j square. So if you have sufficiently small times, you get j square. And I think it's interesting it happens at small times, because you want to measure at small times. So if you look at this rescale Fisher information, which I didn't even have time to think about, but you should really rescale Fisher information by the time, and then you get sensitivities per square root of Hertz, as experimenters usually like anyhow.
Second question. So I think you said the idea of the chaotic sensor is because you have instabilities which help you distinguish between states. So my related question, there's other schemes where people have tried to use it, like I think the interferometry experiments in Obertaler's group, but this is non-chaotic systems and using a specific instabilities. Can you comment on whether one is maybe more flexible, one of the schemes, or more precise, or what are the advantages or disadvantages?
Yeah, I think they're indeed quite related, but the nice thing about chaos, if it's fully developed, is it doesn't really matter where you are with your state, right? Whereas in instability, typically you have to tune your state to be right on the edge of this thing. And as I said, we also see this to some extent with this edge states here. If you're right here on the edge of such a instability island, you get the highest sensitivity. But I think the principles are quite similar. I mean, one should also say the whole thing is really related to spin squeezing physics. I mean, what people normally do is, you could say you just have one single pulse at the very beginning, and this makes the squeezing, and then they have a time evolution. But this is, if you have the coherence, it's not optimal. It's much better to keep squeezing in between. And as I said, the machine actually could learn quite well how to do it, because they recreate coherences all the time, whereas otherwise they just decay exponentially and are gone.
So I may have missed this when you described it, but so how does the quantum chaotic sensor, or the quantum advantage of the quantum chaotic sensor, compare to, say, the performance of a classical chaotic sensor?
I think that's hard to compare, because classically you would calculate the classical Fisher information, right? So you have to say something about the distribution of a quantity that you want to measure that. Yeah, I mean, you have to specify more than just saying, okay, this is a classical sensor. Maybe you might have to optimize over many different things, but we certainly need the coherence in the whole thing. If you make dissipation very strong, then this doesn't work anymore.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. So you have to compare it with a classical chaotic sensor. I don't know what that is like, but what would the comparison be?
I don't know. I mean, the frank answer is I don't know. We didn't look at the classical chaotic sensor. In the sense
how do you know that the quantum chaotic sensor is better than the classical chaotic sensor?
And it's hard to imagine how you get the n-square scaling in the classical case, because this is really an effect of coherences, quantum coherences. So once you kill those completely, I don't think that you can possibly get any scaling like j-square.
So I'm confused, because, I mean, the coherence argument applies even in the absence of chaos.
Yeah, but not classically. It doesn't apply classically.
So I'm trying to understand what the quantum chaos brings to a sensor then.
Chaos, maybe I should say, is really a word which refers essentially to the quantum mechanics of a classically chaotic system. So the classical behavior is chaotic, of this kick top, and then we look at the quantum mechanics of such a system.
Okay, very, very short one. So did you consider also what happens beyond the case of a Lindblad noise? So when you have, for example, time-dependent rates in the master equation?
No, we haven't looked at this yet, no.
Okay. Because this normally in parameter estimation can play an important role, and also the estimation time.
Yeah, we just haven't done it, yeah.
Yes, sir, I have a question on that sort of related to the Aminesh question. Is that sort of normally sort of using on the to show the Heisenberg limit, Heisenberg bound, we have to use that sort of unbiased estimator.
Yes.
But this is kind of that sort of, I worry about in that this you are quantum chaotic sensor is satisfied under unbiased estimate association?
I mean, we always assume that we have unbiased estimators because this is what the whole quantum Fisher information concept is based upon. And yeah. I mean, yes, there is a statement that biased estimators can do even better, but I never took this very seriously because if you allow me to be unbiased, I can have a perfect estimator and then there's no fluctuations at all. I could just say, okay, the estimate is 5 and there's no fluctuations to it, right? But yeah. It's not the right value, so it's not a useful instrument.
Right, okay.
Lincoln, you wanted to make a comment? We have. Okay. So because we have 3 minutes, if you wanted to add something.
Sure. Yeah. So it's a comment, and you can totally disagree. So I'll pose it as a question. How about that? Is it possible that a reasonable comparison, even if you don't have, you know, a classical particle chaos comparison, what about a classical wave chaos comparison? After all, the kind of quantum chaos you're talking about is also classical wave chaos. There really isn't a difference. Mm. Would that help us understand, you know, whether entanglement was a central feature, whether it's just about wave chaos?
Actually, I think one would have to specify what one means with with wave chaos in this case here. I mean, one needs to compare systems in the end, right? And possibly change only one parameter to compare them. So, I mean, I know about wave chaos, yes, but I don't know how to frame this whole thing with, let's say, classical wave chaos, right? I mean, you might think about it, indeed, the system is just classical, let's say, microwave billiards, right? And you change slightly a parameter, and maybe it's also much more sensitive if it's in the chaotic regime. I don't know, it's possible.
Yeah, and that sort of leads to the other question I was going to ask, but I'm probably out of time. Okay, so, and that's really, if you have more than one kick top that you're using as your probe, so you start getting quantum many-body chaos, which is well beyond, you know, quantum chaos or classical wave chaos, would you get an additional advantage? Have you thought about that? It seems like that's, computable, at least for a couple of kick tops.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, in principle, one can think of the spin as decomposed into subsystems, right? And then you would do the kicking and also dissipation for all of them. But we haven't done a systematic study of this at all. I mean, it's just the beginning, I would say.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I don't have the answer.
Okay, so we should move on. Thank you very much, Daniel, for this wonderful talk.
Thanks.
Thank you.